Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I was invited to write a short paper on something that's close to my heart and mind these years, namely scientism. And so I want to say a few words about that before I start. I love science, and I think all people in the room love science. And by that, I mean like the natural sciences. In the recent years, though, we have seen that some people love science so much that they give science a certain status that it doesn't seem to deserve. And Peter has actually helped me that in the paper I, at certain points, conflate two different issues. On the one hand, we find people saying that only science provides knowledge. So moral beliefs, religious beliefs, beliefs based on introspection, that's all those sorts of beliefs, they don't provide knowledge. They don't count as knowledge because they don't reach the bar of being based on scientific inquiry. Only science provides reliable knowledge. And on the other hand, we also find a view that science has no limits. So science can discover all truths in principle that are out there. And I kind of discuss both issues and sometimes conflate them. So probably we'll get back to that in a discussion. Now one might think, well, scientism is an extreme approach, right? There are no limits to science. Only science provides knowledge. I mean, who's willing to defend that? But I found that an increasing number of people say so. Not only the new atheists like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett, but also philosophers like Alex Rosenberg and James Ladyman, some of whom have actually a background in science. And even though their number is still relatively small, their influence is big these days. I mean, they sell millions of copies of their books, and they speak at lots of events. So I do think it's an important view to address because of the influence it has had. So my criticisms would be, well, twofold. On the one hand, I think there are good reasons to think that scientism is false. And on the other hand, I would think scientism has disastrous consequences. So if we truly think that moral views are just views, opinions, but they don't amount to knowledge or rational belief, right? I think that will influence our moral views in the long run and their social acceptability. And I think we see this happen, for instance, when it comes to free will. And so people start to change juridical practices because they believe there is no such thing as free will. Okay, so I think it has a tremendous influence. And what I've tried to do in this paper is understand what motivates people to embrace scientism, and whether there are reasons to think that it's untenable. Now, it's a short paper, like 3,000 words maybe, 4,000. So I couldn't do a whole lot. So what I try to do is to say, well, if scientism is to be credible, this is what it has to do. This is where the arguments have to come from. And then I mentioned like debunking arguments and that sort of thing. So I think that's the work adherents of scientism need to do, whether they are scientists or philosophers. Now, this is all rather abstract. So during the last 2 years or so, with a few colleagues of mine, I've tried to make this slightly more visible. So before we start, I would like to spend like 1 minute trying to make this more visible to you. And that's why I brought a little something, a map. So let me briefly explain. So it's called the Experience Map of Scientism, and the subtitle is What the World Looks Like If Science is the Measure of All Things. So it kind of visualizes the world through the eyes of someone who embraces scientism. So in the middle, we have the metropolis of science with the cathedral of physics. Like, this is the best science you get, of course. It's over there. Thanks, Bruce. And then right below the metropolis of science, we have the wall of reason that divides what is rational, the northern part, from what is irrational, doesn't meet the standards of knowledge. South of the Wall of Reason. So there we find, for instance, the City of God, the Swamps of the Scholastics over there, the Meadow of the Schizophrenics with people like John Lennox, the Faraday Institute, Francis Collins. Those people must be schizophrenics, right? They do science, but they also believe in God. Something is wrong with them. The forest of metaphysics, with people like Plantinga and... Oh, the humanities, that's a desert, of course. The desert of the humanities, right over there. And unfortunately, we can go through the gates of reason, ratio gate, and then we enter the land without illusions, basically. And there's a lot more going on. So here we have the Fleet of the Bright, with people like Dawkins and Dennett and Harris. Hitchens isn't there, so he's in the harbor because he's no longer among us. But still influential. So those were a few brief words. It's in the bookstore, and it kind of visualizes the abstract ideas that I put forward. Thank you.
Well, for a moment, I felt like I was at show and tell, and I was having a fun with it all. And now, Peter, you can respond. Thank you.
All right. I will, of course, not summarize my response because I assume that all of you had took the time to read it. I would rather like to illustrate it, but I don't have a map for that. This is actually quite very good, and I really appreciated Rick's paper. And together with the map, this is, I think, really an outline of what many scientists and many people would believe in. I'd like to respond by relating two experiences. I have to. I don't want to go into detail because that would be breaches of confidence. As a background, for those of you who don't know, I'm in a biosciences faculty with about 40 professors from biology, biochemistry, pharmacy, biotechnology, and imagine a faculty board meeting. And one of the professors from the biosciences department has supported a talk in the university on the resurrection of Jesus given by Gary Habermas, who was a speaker in this forum a couple of years ago. And this scientist who has supported and has even written a summary of Gary Habermas' talk on Jesus' resurrection, a summary for the university magazine, gets accosted by a colleague who says, what has a scientist got to do with resurrection? So the answer was, if I remember correctly, science, well, we would have had to been on the spot to measure blood pressure or something when the actual resurrection occurred. But there is historical science, isn't there? And the person who gave that talk, he was a historian, a professor of history and philosophy. So we have history as a science. I trust you're all aware that in German, and I think also in Dutch, it's Wissenschaft, Wetenschap, which comprises both science and humanities. So one thing which, in a response, I would ask to consider when you talk about science, don't just talk about the natural sciences, because you will make friends if you take in the humanities, even if they are not Christians. Which sources and methods of inquiry other than natural scientists are allowed? Quite a lot within the university, which understands itself in the sense of Bruce Little's summary, which he gave to the first session we had this morning. Secondly, just 2 weeks ago, I gave a seminar for just about 20 pharmacy undergraduates on psychopharmaceutical agents, psychopharmaceutical drugs. And we talked about how do you diagnose and administer, how much do you have to give, when is a person actually a schizophrenic, apart from the guys that have been put on this map in psychiatry. And it transpired that for several of the students, science students, of course, they wanted to have an objective measure. When I was explaining that you need a person to evaluate your state, your mental state, and they didn't trust that. They would rather trust a machine reading. And my spontaneous answer to one of the students was, if you want that, you will be alone. She understood. So subjective trust is a constitutive element of science and humanities. And we certainly need to take that into account if we want to show that there is knowledge beyond this border which you just showed. There is knowledge. Now let me just pick out a few remarks from my response. I think the paper was a very clear and elaborate refutation of strong scientism, just 3,000 words, but that is about as much as a common or garden variety of a scientist would be ready to read, unless he is particularly interested in philosophy. That is very sad. I'm a bit embarrassed that I have to admit that, but it's just a fact. What I lacked when I looked at the paper, just as a scientist, where are the definitions? What is the method? How did you come to your conclusions? There was no methodical part, no data part, and that is something which we would always look for. Of course, that is a gross misunderstanding of what a philosophical paper looks like, but if you want us to read it, maybe the format could be changed a little bit. Just a suggestion. I trust you don't mind my wording it like this. The ordinary, you're absolutely right. People like the ones you quoted seem to be very influential, especially in the English-speaking world. I know people who have never heard the name Dennett. A lot of German scientists will not have come across the name of Daniel Dennett, and I don't tell them about him. So the usual scientist, the normal scientist, will have his specialization. He will only feel confident in his field of specialization, and it will be coupled with some sort of agnosticism about everything else. So again, this trust question. Who do we trust? Which sources of knowledge do we allow? We know, and there is, of course, behind this, there is this cultural epistemology, like in the past we know very little. We knew very little. We've come to accrue more knowledge. Now we know a lot, and we will know even more in the future. And that, of course, could be doubted, depending on what you count as knowledge. If you just count engineering, science, this kind of thing, okay. But what about other cultural knowledge aspects? So finally, and in my final remarks, I would like to connect this session to the previous one, how to base an intellectual enterprise on the Bible. Which parts of the Bible come to mind when you want to find a framework for science? And the parts of the Bible which I find very helpful for science, natural science as such, natural science, not humanities, just science, in the sense that I believe Rick's paper was intended, are Ecclesiastes and Proverbs. Ecclesiastes shows you how far science can reach. And it shows that the scientists, even though they all the time claim to be objective, are looking for meaning. They are looking for meaning even if they don't always admit it. And Proverbs, because it reminds us that the word the Bible seems to use for what we call science is wisdom. Now I'm again referring to the previous presentation by Peter J. Williams. Which word would we want to use? I would suggest to use the word wisdom. Philosophers do it all the time, and they love Sophia, they love wisdom. Because wisdom comprises more than what the natural sciences comprise. And I think you can comparatively easily convince scientists perhaps not to read a 600-page philosophy book on scientism, but to talk to you about other sources of knowledge which might be called wisdom. In my PhD thesis, I came to be a Christian at the age of 25, and after that I finished my PhD thesis as a kind of motto. I was younger than I am now at that time, half the age actually. I don't want you to guess. I put Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding." Because scientists, if they're honest, and they try to be, usually, will accept a claim to humility. A claim to humility. And that is what wisdom is always connected to humility in Proverbs and in Ecclesiastes. So, wisdom, from practical experience, wisdom under the sun, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Finally, a definition of science from René Descartes, from his Regulae ad Directionem Ingenii. All sciences are nothing but human wisdom that stays the same no matter which object it turns itself to. So try to take the subjective wisdom aspect, including humility, into your consideration of science. I would think that could give an inroad to the common or garden variant of a scientist who is at trepidation to debate a philosopher. Thank you.
Thank you. Your response?
So thank you for your response, Peter. It's been very helpful for me. And I even tried to anticipate it a bit in my previous presentation. So let me say just a couple of remarks in response. So this paper was meant for this audience, for you, basically. So Christian audience with a background in science or philosophy or theology or apologetics. If I were to present something along these lines to a secular audience consisting of scientists, I would do it very differently. So I think I would focus on their particular discipline and try to show for, say, moral knowledge or knowledge regarding wisdom that there is such a thing, right? So that there are limits to science and that there is knowledge beyond science. But that requires a lot of work, actually. So take moral knowledge. It's highly disputed that there is such a thing, and there are like these evolutionary debunking arguments of the idea that we have moral knowledge. And lots of people are moral relativists with regard to moral beliefs. So I would have to meet all those objections and build an argument. So I think I would do that for specific sources. And same thing for religious belief or beliefs about based on introspection. So that's why I sketched a general picture here. I should have said something more about what science and knowledge are. So I take by science I mean the natural sciences for the purposes of this paper. Because it's usually the natural sciences that tend to be somewhat, have a tendency towards colonialism in a way. Physics or biology tends to say, well, everything is a matter of physics or everything is a matter of random mutation and natural selection. Say people in history or theology tend to be slightly more modest. And I think the humanities are under a threat, not so much physics. Let me see. There's one more thing that I wanted to say, which is one comment at the towards the end of your paper about the cognitive consequences of sin.
That was a minor point. Didn't mention in my today's summary.
You didn't mention it, but I. So you ask, shouldn't we take? So I say something like, as Christians, we can go wherever the evidence leads, because God is a God of truth. So there's nothing to be afraid of, as what I say somewhere in the paper. And then you, I think, rightly ask, what about the cognitive consequences of sin? Hasn't sin also affected our cognition? So in response, I would like to wholeheartedly underline what you say. So my response would be, that is actually part of our evidence. So the fact that sin has affected our thinking is part of our evidence. I think that's something we can know. And that's something we should take into account. So if we go where the evidence leads, that's also something we should take into consideration. Those were the main things I wanted to say in response.
Respond.
I think, Rick, if you venture into the field of a scientist like physics or biology, that, of course, is could be dangerous, or it could involve a lot of work. I know that because sometimes I am asked questions which are well outside my own field, even though I'm a scientist. Of course, I'm not a physicist, I'm not a biologist.
Right.
Sometimes people say, don't scientists assume work on the principle of methodological atheism? So to that I respond, I try to be a relatively methodical chemist. I don't define myself by excluding God, but by including all the methods which my science involves, meaning other methods I'm not familiar with. So if you venture into something concrete, depends on the audience. But what I would perhaps suggest, but I'm afraid I'm not suggesting anything which is new to you, I would suggest to pick a subject which has, if I get the term right, qualia character. Of late, because I'm basically a medicinal chemist, I've used the subject of pain, because pain has a lot of scientific, medical science, and even biochemical science, neurological science aspects. But at the same time, it's something very subjective, very personal. So you get a good... You make people easily understand that, of course, there is a scientific part to this subject, or rather object, of pain, but there is also a subjective part. And that helps a lot because this personal trust, this trusting, rather than just trusting in something which we think is objective, because a machine tells us what we should think, that is that we have to counter.
Right, yeah. So I think especially the philosophy of mind is... when it comes to consciousness, qualia, like pain and or other, certain emotions like love, they are a great topic, I think, to show where scientism goes wrong in a particular field.
Yeah,
I fully agree. Yeah,
the standard scientist would I think answer the question of your paper: are there any limits to science? With yes, of course, but we are going to make the country larger. I mean, this is an island. You should allow for
right.
increase of the country, new, like the Netherlands have done, gain something from. It looked a bit like the Netherlands, I think. This.
There might
the
have
shape of the
subconsciously.
Country. Is that a coincidence?
Yeah, maybe so.
A scientist would say, "Yes, of course there are limits, but beyond the limits, how can we be sure?"
Well, but I'm not sure, because these days there's an increasing number of people who say, well, there are no limits in the sense that only science, I mean, science has this method of anonymous peer review, we can test it again, and that selects for something that becomes reliable knowledge. Whereas in morality or free will or, you know, consciousness might be an illusion, there's no knowledge to be had there. I think an increasing number of scientists say such a thing, even though there are lots of others who...
That
worries me.
Sure. It worries me. Yeah. Because in my faculty, I think people would tend to talk like that in public. In private, they might talk differently, depending on their personal situation. Because the subjective, I think, is so important to bring in. I think in the previous session, somebody said, some of the Peters that are around, I'm actually Peter, not Peter, if you want to... distinguish me from the gentleman from the UK. Somebody said that the word of God speaks to an individual, so this subjective personal relationship is so important to hold on to when we want to. It's so important for trust. Like this student who was, the students told me, well, one psychiatrist would say, I'm okay. Another one would perhaps say, you are paranoid. Another one would say, you are rather paranoid. How can I be sure? So the problem is trust between persons. And that is something what we are aiming at. We want people to trust God and each other. I think that's very much at the heart of Christianity. So I want to get away from this objectiveness, say that it has its place, but in other places we live differently, we argue differently, and still we have knowledge. Encounters, knew his wife. Adam knew his wife. That is again from the paper which Peter J. Williams presented. Rather, they had something with each other. They knew each other. There is again knowledge, not in the sense of science, but of personal encounter.
We could now have questions from the audience. While you're coming to the microphone, I would like to ask. Peter, a question. You say that as science, but would you think that maybe a biologist might not be as charitable as you are being as a chemist.
What do you mean by charitable?
Well, that...
I understand the word, but I'm, usually I understand to give money to something.
No.
I know you mean a different thing.
I'm ready. No. I mean that you seem to draw a much softer line with the limits of science, whereas would a biologist tend to draw that line much thicker and much stronger?
Let me relate something. I think it will be an answer. I was asked by biochemistry students to do a lecture on ethics in the biosciences, because biosciences very often try to apply their knowledge in medicine. So they said, we always do an excursion to a company or someplace when we get a lecture. Which excursion do you suggest? So I did some thinking, and then I told them, why don't you visit a place where people are helped while they are dying? The German word is hospice. Is that an English word?
Yes.
Because there you will see the limits of science. So I think biologists, scientists who are into medicine somehow, they will be very aware of the limits and of the subjectiveness of the empirical, very empirical nature of... That answers your question, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, thank you. Question to Rick about the distinction you draw between strong and weak scientism. And the way I've often seen weak scientism characterized is as the idea that although science is not the only way to knowledge, that nonetheless it is the most reliable way of knowledge, whereas you characterize it as the idea that only science is the only way to get knowledge in a particular field, whilst admitting that there are other ways to know things outside of that. So I wanted to, if you could comment upon that.
Yeah, right. So one of the problems with the debate about scientism is that the terminology. I mean, like weak scientism, partial scientism, those words are used in very different ways. So I focused on these varieties of scientism because I think there is something to be said. There's something to be said for the view that science is more reliable than other sources of knowledge. So two things can be both sources of knowledge, while the one is more reliable. Why? Well, because it's checked time and again. It's compared with other material. And that's what scientists try to do. On the other hand, I think I pointed out that in the paper, science itself is based on like the five senses, for instance, on memory, sometimes on introspection. So those sources are used. And so even if you check it time and again, you're still using those other sources. So it can't make it more reliable than those other sources because you're using them time and again. I don't think it's the most interesting version of scientism. That's why I kind of put it to the side. But I think it's out there. I agree, yeah.
That satisfied? Yes.
My name is Miikka Niiranen, and I'm running a website that deals with these questions regularly. And one of the subjects is scientism, for instance. And an objection that we run into frequently when dealing with limits of science is the equation, practically, of a limit and a gap. So when theology is brought into the picture, naturally, at some point, when discussing limits of science, how would you advise, Rick, what would be the most effective and sort of, in a nutshell, the best answer to that you cannot equate limits of science with the traditional God of the gaps thing, that there is a legitimate distinction between those two things?
Right, yeah, so I would actually endorse that. So if you read, for instance, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's letters from prison, he already, so in the final parts, so towards the end of the book, he talks about the God of the gaps, which is very, which is a big topic in apologetics, right, these days. And he already talks about it. And he warns for a God of the gaps. And I think he rightly warns for that. So I think my response will be to point out that most people who believe in God don't believe in God because they run into some phenomenon that they cannot explain and then say, well, I cannot explain this on a natural basis. Therefore, I postulate that there is a God. So I think for most people who believe in God is not a hypothesis meant to explain gaps. I think that's one way one could respond. So it could be based, I think religious belief is often based on experiences, on the testimony, on the Bible, those sorts of things. And not so much on there being gaps. So it's perfectly compatible that one has knowledge, say, of God or of moral norms, not because there is a gap. That would be my response.
Let me just quickly add that in my apologetic talks, I simply quote Sir Peter Medawar, who said that there are lots of important questions which, if scientists say they are silly, they are wrong. Sir Peter Medawar got a Nobel Prize in science. And I quote Erwin Schrödinger, but just for some of the gentlemen around to understand this name, sorry, who wrote a similar thing. You can find both quotes in John Lennox's book, God's Undertaker, and I think that works quite well. I tried to show that some questions are invisible to science. Questions that are invisible to science. We cannot even ask them, but they are there. They're real. Pain is real. Looking for meaning is real. That's how, very simply, not really philosophically, but in talking to students, and I think you also have a very open audience to your website, I try to counter that.
Can I say one more thing quickly? Sure. And so I would point out what I just said, but I would also say that I would just repeat, we should go where the evidence leads. So when it comes to the fine-tuning, for instance, or the Big Bang, if, as things stand, God as a designer of the universe is the best explanation, that is, I think, what it is rational to believe, until further evidence shows up that somehow undermines that. So I think there are different kinds of gaps. For some gaps, we shouldn't appeal to God, but other gaps, it's perfectly legitimate. But one needs to do a bit of work to explain the difference between the kinds of gaps.
That's exactly what I would want to hear.
Ah, great. Well, here you go.
Okay, yes.
My name is Martin Verkerk from the Netherlands. Rick, I would like to thank you for the quite clear paper, and I think that the three arguments you are giving are quite convincing from a philosophical point of view. Quite convincing. I think it are really the best arguments. But there's only one question.
And why, comes, yeah.
Why
I tremble.
Can't we convince people like Dawkins with that type of arguments? And I'm referring to Kuhn. Kuhn was saying in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, at a certain moment, he says, when people go from one theory to another theory, it is like a conversion. So please explain me or help me why we cannot convince people with this type of views that they are wrong. Because I think surely you're right.
Ooh, that's not an easy question. Or at least not easy to answer. So it's also partly a psychological question about people such as Richard Dawkins. And I'm not a psychologist. So maybe biography does play a role here. I do like the idea of Kuhn, that people might live in different paradigms, right? And that there needs to be a paradigm shift. So a Gestalt switch. From one paradigm to the other. But as Kuhn says, in order to switch from one paradigm to the other, one needs rational arguments, but also something, well, other factors play a role, like cultural and psychological factors. One just needs to look at it differently. Really, I find it very hard to get people to look at things radically differently. I think maybe the best way is just to get to know them and become friends with them and show how this particular paradigm of theism, for instance, how it works and makes sense of things.
Kuhn says there are some theories that only stop because the people who believe in it die.
Die out.
Yes, so that says something about what happens. Well, sometimes my experience is that only sometimes you can convince people by rational arguments. Sometimes you can only convince them when there is a pressing problem, so pressing that they cannot solve it in their own worldview, in their own paradigm. So basically, my question is, can you help us to find some so pressing problems that when you are in the field of scientism, you have to say, no, I can't accept that, because a lot of the consequences of scientism is, for example, basically, if you believe in scientism in a natural way like Dawkins, there's not something like mercy. There's not something like caring for people. We are all in one evolutionary fight. And when my kids become a part of that fight of the weak people, I hate that. So my question is, do you have examples how to do that?
Well, so, yeah. So Kuhn talks about anomalies, right? So anomaly is something that doesn't fit the paradigm, like a particular observation or a set of observations. And I could try to do the same for the paradigm of scientism. So try to show that there are things that don't make sense on a scientific worldview. One thing I try to do is to show that one thing that doesn't make sense on a scientific worldview is scientism itself. Right? It's not supported. You could try to make similar moves in other areas, but one reply that I encounter quite often is, well, there's consciousness, right? Consciousness is bizarre and it doesn't fit the scientific worldview. But then, hey, it's 2015. Give us a couple of years, right? Or maybe a couple of centuries. We will figure it out in the end. Like Francis Crick, for instance, was an adherent of scientism. And he just thought, consciousness, you know, it takes time. We will solve it in the end. And that's a move one can always make. It doesn't fit the paradigm, but give us enough time and we will find it out. And that's the irrational part. So one can do only so much from a rational point of view, I'm afraid.
Go ahead, Alan.
I would like to make the point of Richard Dawkins maybe more clearly, because I think, okay, if you are Richard Dawkins, all three arguments would be refutable that you give against scientism, because he would probably define science much more as a method to gain knowledge as infallible as possible. So of course we use common sense. Common sense is not a counter argument, but we know that we have common sense, we are using it all the time. But for a single person, common sense of course can be fallible. So what are we doing? We're doing it objectively, which means intersubjectively, actually, today, and then reproducible and testable. And we, of course, use also the senses. We have empiricism and we have logic and deduction. So that's what we are using. And in order to be as infallible as possible, we don't just use one person, but we use many and include everyone. So everyone should be able to understand that. And then, of course, this is the only reliable method by which you can gain knowledge. Everything else is just a first-person experience, and therefore fallible, might be an illusion, and therefore it's not knowledge, it's just faith. And at the same time, the only way to get around that is that you believe in something like God. But who, except you guys here, believe that there is such a thing like a God? So all three arguments that you present here are easily refuted by myself.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, some 80 to 85% of the world believes there is one God or several gods. So not only these people, like the vast majority of people in the world actually believe that there is a God. So I think he would make that move. And I would point out all that follows from that is that science is a great method to increase the reliability, right? And that's all that follows, basically. It doesn't follow that what you start from is not reliable. In fact, it needs to be fairly reliable to end up with reliable results, right? If visual perception is unreliable and memory is unreliable, and you employ it, you know, those very things, you employ it in testing something time and again, then you won't end up with a reliable result. So they need to be reliable to some extent in order to get a reliable result. So it makes things slightly more reliable, sure. It doesn't follow that the other things are unreliable, let alone like moral beliefs. That's one thing I would say. Another thing I would say is I think we do check those other beliefs. It's just that we don't do it in the way of science. So we don't use anonymous peer review and that sort of thing. But we do discuss our moral views with other people and our religious views. And we do consider whether it fits science, it fits what we know from history, and so on. So we do checking and corroboration, although we don't do it in the scientific way. Those are a few of the things I would say. What about you, Peter?
I don't think I want to add anything to that because I see there are more people on the floor who would like to ask questions or give comments.
Just two short points I'd like you to comment on. One, the problem that's happening in the modern world is that the science is collapsing, in my view, under a lack of a moral basis. In other words, since it can't support morals, the exercise of proper scientific ethics and morality is decaying. There was an article in the Telegraph just in the last few days arguing that point in some detail. And I've experienced it as a physicist, where a paper that my name is actually on is wrong because someone else who had control manipulated the data in an incorrect fashion. So if someone would ask me, are these results reliable, I'd say no, the claimed accuracy of the method is no better than half as good as is claimed because of I watched the manipulation happen. So the lack of a moral base actually decays science's ability to understand the objective world. That's one point. And the other point is just that especially when you're reasoning backward in time, you need to, every time you come to a bifurcation point in possibilities, you really need to honestly explore both. But resources never get devoted to alternatives in the way when an idea begins to catch, the other ideas competing don't get funding, they don't get effort. Especially with big science, it's a problem because you can't repeat the experiments anymore. They're too expensive. So I think there are some erosive forces that mean that science should become more humble, especially in reasoning into the past. So could you comment on that?
Right, yeah. That is fascinating. So that will be another move to make to question the reliability of science itself. Right. And I think internationally there have been some scandals recently, right, that caught the media attention. And there is like skewing the data or cooking the data. There is like ghost authors, especially in fields like medicine. The influence of the pharmaceutical industry is massive and distorts the results of science and undermines the reliability. So I fully agree with that. But then I think lots of scientists and also adherents of scientism also agree that that is a problem and that we need to work on it and improve it.
I don't think I would feel very happy with trying to debunk science by pointing at blunders. I mean, they could do the same with Christianity. Yeah, they could. And rightly so.
Precisely.
I think you may underestimate the pervasiveness of this and the way that desired results warp the way science is being done more and more, especially without a moral basis for sticking to objective truth.
Thank you, Rick, for a well-reasoned and clear paper. I'd like to come back to one of the points that we discussed in our earlier philosophical network. And that is, I think you can make your argument and your whole project stronger by also having a look at ethnographical research among how science are working. Foucault has, for example, clearly described the discovery of the structure of DNA. And there is a lot of contingency and a lot of power struggle in this whole thing going around. And to give you one historical example, genetics and eugenics were one and the same science when they started at the end of the 19th century. And up to the Second World War, in fact, it was one science. And now we can say, of course, they were wrong, and how could it be so misunderstanding? The top of the genetic scientists of that time defended eugenics. And not just in Germany. As you all know, probably, the United States had a very strong, and some of the other countries in Europe as well, England and not the least. So you can say, well, does it help to point at the blunders of science? I think it demonstrates that what is considered the truth of the day, half a century later, is considered a great error. So we must be very modest in the claim that science reveals truth. And maybe to finish with a quote from Einstein. Einstein has written in one of his essays, "The relationship between the scientific formula and reality is not like the relationship between the meat and the soup." That is a real relationship. "But it is between the number of the wardrobe and your coat. You can perfectly find it back. It doesn't say anything about the rope."
Yes, so thank you, Hank. I think that is helpful. Should be modest as scientists, or we? I'm a philosopher. Scientists should be modest, and
philosophers too.
And especially given the history of science, right, and the paradigm shifts there have been. Some people also point to the contingencies of science, and I'm somewhat more skeptical. So I think it was Popper, Karl Popper, who distinguished between the context of discovery and the context of justification. So in the context of discovery, for instance, the discovery of antibiotics, there was a whole series of contingencies the way it was discovered, right? And many of them were all sorts of irrational factors. However, once it has been discovered, there can be a good justification for it, for a particular theory or for the idea that this medicine works. So even if how it came about is a matter of lots of contingencies, the fact that we can justify it now suffices for the rationality of accepting that scientific result. Do you see? So
I see
historical contingency doesn't necessarily undermine
the
result.
I agree. Okay. I think your point is valid. At the same time, even in the context of justification, there can be a mistake.
Sure.
And there can be, there can be an error. I mean, justification, like the number in the wardrobe, I mean, it can work in a sense, but it is a very limited understanding of reality. And if you make this the way of seeing things and acting according to it, you may be damaging. I mean, the debate in genetics, there was a debate in the United States, and there was a concept of the gene in Europe in the mid-20th century, completely different concepts. The European form was, we find now, was much better. But the American point of view at that time was much stronger. And they prevailed, and they were part of the whole eugenics history. It's just an example of showing that science can be off the road significantly. Who guarantees that the knowledge we now say this is scientific knowledge, this is the body of knowledge, we are not off the road significantly as well? That it works is not proof of its full relationship to reality.
I would like to comment on the contingencies of philosophy. The main contingency, of course, is the philosophers themselves. You may be wrong. And another one is language, because you are operating with a lot of words. I mean, we try to operate with words in different languages even. And, as a scientist, I would say, I would prefer numbers rather than words, because numbers are sort of less equivocal than words tend to be. Of course, words transport a lot more meaning, which, again, is corroborative of what we as Christians try to convey. But I think this aspect of humility, which you've reminded us scientists of, I think we should all be reminded of it. And even if you try to convince a person, I'm not talking about Richard Dawkins, because he seems to be like the soul and epitome example, some person who is really convinced that there is no such thing as God or anything, how can you convince him? I think by making a clear argument, leading a clear life, and at the same time, when you argue, when you write a book or something, show that you are struggling, show your human face, show the subjective aspect, because you want to win trust, not an argument, which is, sorry, this is a very, very trivial thing to say, but I think I wanted to bring it up at this point after I've listened to some of the remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Rick, thank you for your paper and your clear analysis of scientism. Clearly, scientism is like a juggernaut today in the West in particular, and increasingly in the East. I want to get practical. How are we going to, in reaching my own country, and I do quite a lot of apologetics, as some of you know, we're up against it, particularly in evangelism. We seek to use the very arguments that you've outlined in your paper, and which Peter has fine-tuned to a certain extent, but basically we all agree on them. But I just wanted to raise an issue. How are we going to go forward with this? And could it be that the real problem, because the gospel we read is the power of God unto salvation, right? Romans 1:16. And so when I'm in the open air seeking to speak to people, I know that it's actually not my argument that's going to win a person to Christ. It's going to be the gospel itself. Now, could I just ask whether you would agree with this, that possibly one of the reasons we're weak, and I know God uses weak vessels, I'm not particularly going down that argument, I'm saying one of the reasons that we appear to be weak today, is it because scientism has come into the church? That's the question I want you to address. Are we actually guilty of scientism? And I'd like you to perhaps address that in the church.
So are we guilty of scientism in the church itself? I think we are to some extent. I can't pronounce on the US, but or on Europe as a whole. But in the Netherlands, for instance, maybe the majority of the people in church, I'm not sure about that, a large percentage, has embraced the view that belief in God is not rational. It is an irrational thing. And there's some influence by Karl Barth there, whether or not that is what Barth had in mind. And it do ascribe like a high status to natural science. And I think rightly so, but at the cost of, say, religious belief. So they go along with it and say, so they accept the noma, so the non-overlapping magisteria idea, right? So there's science and there's, well, my belief in God, but those are two separate things. And so they keep the two apart. And in doing so, they often embrace scientism. So they accept the idea that their belief is not rational, that they don't have knowledge, that it's something entirely subjective. Yes, unfortunately, it's true.
Well,
yeah,
if
basically.
I could just put a rejoinder, that is the way I was going in my thinking, and I was interested that you agree with that point. Because if we don't believe ourselves properly in the power of the gospel and the fact that it does actually embrace some aspects of scientific activity. And we are basically in the church beginning to worship an idol of scientism. Then maybe that's why we're not being blessed as we should do, should be in our evangelism to our fellow academics. It's the academic world that I particularly want to reach for the Lord.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think, well, I fully agree. And so one danger is that one embraces scientism because people push scientism into society and into the church. Another danger is that people reject science. That's another thing I see among Christians. That so if they say, well, if it's either, only science provides knowledge, belief in God, well, I'll go for belief in God because I've experienced God myself. So science is out of the door. And that's a shame.
Well, it's not just a shame. It's a crucial mistake.
It's a crucial mistake. Yeah. And it has
thank you, Rick.
Terrible consequences, yeah. Appreciate I think we fully agree there.
Daniel?
Thank you. I'm Daniel Hill from the Philosophers Network. Thank you very much to Rick and to Peter. So, question primarily to Rick. I wondered if you'd come across Douglas Fitch's theorem of knowability that is a refutation of hard scientism as you've defined it.
So whose theory is
Douglas
it?
Fitch. So mathematics... So,
no, I haven't, no.
So picking up on... Peter mentioned he prefers numbers to words, but of course Gödel famously showed that there's limits even to mathematics. Yeah. That is to say, there are truths... If mathematics is consistent, there are truths that can't be proven in mathematics.
Right, and you can prove that.
And that is proven mathematics, not just can be proved, he did prove it. Fitch, if you like, has, I wouldn't say gone one better, but he's taken Gödelian methods in a more general form and extended them to epistemic logic, and a pretty weak epistemic logic. Certainly, Dawkins, etc., be hard pushed, I think, to deny his assumption. So the proof depends, for example, on the fact that knowledge is closed under conjunction elimination. So if you know P and Q, it follows you know P and follows you know Q. Bit controversial, but you can't base scientism just on the denial of that. And he shows in this theorem that if everything is knowable in principle, then it follows that everything is known, actually known. Okay, we Christians of course have got no problem with this because we affirm both the antecedent and the consequent, but any humble vaguely humble scientist is going to say, a scientist in the sense of following scientism is going to say, we don't know everything and we've got no reason to believe that we shall know everything. But yet then they have to say that there are some things that are unknowable by Fitch's theorem.
A friend of mine who's a professor of mathematics and a Christian told me once that mathematics after Gödel knew that they cannot explain everything because they are not even fully consistent in themselves. And he said that physics, after the quantum revolution, also found that they cannot explain everything by some set of physical laws, although some physicists may still believe in that. And he says biology is still waiting for the moment where they will find out that they cannot explain everything. But on the other hand, of course, I mean, it's again a question of definitions. So if biology claims to cover, like, everything, including the lower sciences, I'm inverting the map you've drawn, because I think in our time the biologists or the geneticists would like to be at the center rather than the physicists, and rightly so. they're still waiting for this revelation of the incompleteness of every human enterprise, and that I think is all we can do. And show that we trust in... We have to bring in the Bible at some point. I mean, if we argue even very consistently, leaving out the Bible, we don't get to where we want to go. We don't get to letting God speak. So that is why I think the first part of our session today was very important, how to base intellectual reasoning on the Bible. How do I bring that in? And I try with colleagues who are teachers in the sciences, I try to instigate them to think, how do I present the matter from a Christian standpoint of view? Not exactly the gospel, but you may want to present things a little bit differently. If I teach psychopharmaceutical agents, I will take account of the subjectivity and the non that I cannot reduce it to molecular mechanisms. And I will teach that very clearly in my regular lectures. But of course, if you have a different subject, you have to think about it in a different way. So that is something. During the GDR times, when East Germany, where I did not grow up, but I now live in what used to be East Germany, Christians who were scientists were removed from the university into research institutes or out of the university because the culture of the day, materialism, they were afraid that the Christians in academia would somehow send a message, even if it was not exactly the gospel message, to the young people. So Christians that were scientists were put into pure research, which can be very interesting depending on personality and interest. But from a Christian gospel standpoint of view, you have to try to stay in teaching and think your subject through from a biblical standpoint of view. How can I understand my subject with the Bible to be the prime source of my understanding of how humans and the world works?
You want to say something? We have about 2 minutes. Anna, you're fine?
I'm fine, yep.
Well, why don't you burn up 2 minutes? Go ahead. You
can. Well, I'm fine. No, so
you're really fine.
Yeah, I fully agree with Peter. Yeah.
Okay, we have 2 minutes.
Okay, I'll be quick. Alistair Donald, the Scientific Network. I'd like to pick up a thread that was earlier about the morality or of peer review and how that may have gone astray. It may not be known to all the non-scientists that peer review came in because Professor Peter Harrison of Oxford has shown, because of a Reformation understanding of human nature. You know, I think this is the way it is, but I may be wrong, so please, will you check my work? But over the years, because there's less humility, then it seems to me that may be the root of the scientific difficulties that have arisen, where there has been scandals that were referred to earlier. So just that if we could recover the authentic peer review, where it is based on the humility that I may be wrong, then you will not have the danger of corruption in the scientific process. Just a comment, and do you think that's right?
Okay, yeah, so I see. So I think peer review is a valuable instrument, but it is not at all immune to all sorts of subjective forces. So for one thing, papers are often sent, so you submit them, and then the editor often selects who is the referee, right? And they might choose someone who's knowledgeable or not knowledgeable, a young person or an experienced person, and they can do that on the basis of what they know about you. This is the case with some journals, right? You might put your paper online, so you can just Google it, right? So I can easily find out as a referee. Or we know each other. So I find out if you write about a topic that a few people are writing about, and you meet with those people at conferences, and then you submit a paper, and you just mention those people in the references, it's very likely to be going to send to those people, and they think, oh, this is Rick's paper. Yeah, let's give a few comments. But and there you go. So I think it's good that there's peer review, but it's not at all immune to subjective forces.
Okay.
So we need more safety mechanisms than that.
I think as I listen to the questions, I think we as Christians really do have to be honest with ourselves that we have often a bias against science. And anything when science speaks, we just automatically think, ah, yeah, that's just the scientists. They must all be atheists. And I think that's a corrective that needs to come in our thinking. Now, I'm not suggesting that's true here. I'm speaking more in the general area. And when Rick speaks about the hard scientism, how many have read the Humanist Manifesto 2000? Yeah, just very few. But in there, you will see that that is the project that is outlined by the humanist, and it is a very hard scientist scientism view of to not just to get rid of religion, but to get rid of the arts, the humanities, everything. Edward O. Wilson, the premier biologist, says in his book on consilience, the main project for humanity is to reduce everything to science, including philosophy. That would also include theology, so I just want to get you all in on that.